Coming up on the show today, Hamas leadership was the target of an airstrike on the Jabalaya refugee camp.
In the course of the fighting, we eliminated many terrorists and destroyed terror infrastructure. This is complicated combat, some of which is face-to-face combat.
Plus, the Houthis in Yemen have stepped into a war 2,500 kilometers away.
On Tuesday, its military spokesperson said the launch was their third since the conflict began.
And later, a conversation with a correspondent in Jerusalem and a look at the economic impacts of Pakistan's decision to expel Afghan migrants. Today is Wednesday, November 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. An update on the U.S. Congress and President Joe Biden's request for more funding to help Israel and Ukraine in a moment. We begin, though, in Israel, where missiles could be seen falling onto Gaza on Tuesday night with explosions and occasional gunfire, as the United States and other countries say they're looking at options for the future of the Strip. Israeli tanks have been active in Gaza for at least 4 days following weeks of air bombardments. On Tuesday, airstrikes hit a densely populated refugee camp, killing at least 50 Palestinians, including a leader of Hamas. Military spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari confirmed the airstrikes on Jabalaya refugee camp and said it targeted a central Hamas stronghold.
Our forces are currently fighting deep inside the Gaza Strip. They are killing terrorists in close range combat, conducting coordinated strikes on terror targets from land, air, and sea. During the afternoon hours, infantry and armored forces secured a central Hamas stronghold in the west part of Jabalia. The stronghold served as a training center for the October 7th massacre and as a passage to the coastline from where additional terrorists set off to perpetrate the October 7th massacre. In the course of the fighting, we eliminated many terrorists and destroyed terror infrastructure. This is complicated combat, some of which is face-to-face combat. During the combat, we lost soldiers.
Palestinian health officials said at least 50 Palestinians were killed and 150 wounded in the incident. The Israeli military has accused Hamas of using civilian buildings as cover for fighters, commanders, and weaponry. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres appealed again on Tuesday for the protection of civilians caught in the conflict, stressing the need for proportional behavior and precautions by all parties. The UN and other aid officials said civilians in Gaza are suffering a public health catastrophe, with hospitals struggling to treat casualties as electricity supplies peter out. Meanwhile, despite worldwide diplomatic efforts to prevent the Israel-Hamas conflict from becoming a wider regional war, Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi movement confirmed on Tuesday that they fired drones and missiles at Israel in attacks that cement the world powers' fears of the conflict widening into other countries. Reuters' Matthew Laratonda has that story.
The declaration came after Israel's military said it intercepted two objects in separate incidents around the Red Sea. This was a Houthi parade filmed by Reuters in Yemen in September, only days before the Hamas attacks on Israel. On Tuesday, its military spokesperson said the launch was their third since the conflict began, seeming to confirm that it was behind an incident on October 19th when the U.S. Navy said it had intercepted three cruise missiles over the Red Sea and a drone attack on October 28th, which resulted in blasts in Egypt, blamed on the Houthis by Israel. The spokesperson said they would continue to launch against Israel until, quote, Israeli aggression ceases. The Houthis are part of what's called the Axis of Resistance, an alliance of armed groups backed by Iran and includes Hamas. It recently released this video said to show their military drills. Israel's military says it will remain focused on Gaza and that the Houthis are just one of many of Iran's proxies, a relationship that the Houthis have denied.
That's Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda reporting. As the situation worsens in the Middle East, top Biden administration officials told U.S. lawmakers on Tuesday that the White House request for $106 billion in emergency supplemental funding, including aid for Ukraine and Israel, is vital to U.S. national security. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin testified as the request faces significant opposition in the Republican-majority U.S. House of Representatives. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
U.S. officials pushing lawmakers Tuesday to move quickly to address war on two fronts, proposing $14.3 billion in U.S. aid to Israel and $61.4 billion in aid to Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin.
American leadership is what holds the world together. And if we fail to lead, the cost and threats to the United States will only grow.
Mike Johnson, the new Republican speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, released legislation late Monday separating aid to Ukraine from aid to Israel. That's a strategic error, according to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
It would do both terrible harm to our values, but also to our core interests. Values because I think all of us are united in wanting to respond to aggressors, to bullies who try to lord it over their neighbors. And in the midst of doing that, inflict incredible suffering.
Opposition to a new round of funding for Ukraine to combat Russian aggression is broader in the House, the lower chamber of the U.S. Congress. But in the U.S. Senate, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has been a key voice supporting continued aid to Ukraine.
Russia would love to see Iranian-backed terrorists in the Middle East weaken America and our allies. Iran would love to see a Russian victory against Ukraine that divides the West and deepens its own defense cooperation with Moscow.
Some Republican senators remain concerned, arguing there is not sufficient oversight of the aid and that the U.S. cannot indefinitely fund a war. Republican Senator John Hoeven.
We need to know that we have a strategy as part of this funding. I think it's very important in terms of building support for the funding for Ukraine.
Members of the Democratic majority Senate would likely block a standalone Israel bid, arguing it must be paired with aid to the Ukraine as requested by the White House. National Security spokesperson John Kirby.
It doesn't meet our national security needs. And as commander in chief, the president's never going to do anything. It doesn't meet our key national security needs.
Austin said not providing aid to Ukraine could ultimately lead to a U.S. confrontation with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
There's no question in my mind that sooner or later he will challenge NATO and we'll find ourselves in a shooting match.
The House could vote on aid to Israel as soon as this Thursday, where there is some opposition to the aid among progressive Democrats. Blinken said assistance to Palestinians would be a key part of that aid.
Humanitarian assistance is also vital to Israel's security. Providing immediate aid and protection for Palestinian civilians in this conflict is a necessary foundation for finding partners in Gaza who have a different vision for the future than Hamas.
Both the White House and Republican aid requests include $10.6 billion in support for Israel's air and missile defense systems. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
And in a late-breaking development Tuesday night, Joe Biden said he would veto a funding bill that separates Israel from Ukraine. And here are more stories we're following from around the world. Vietnam and Japan are poised to elevate their diplomatic ties to the highest level. It's a move that analysts say highlights the two countries' growing concern over China's assertive behavior in the region. A top prosecutor in Niger said on Tuesday that President Mohamed Bazoum, ousted in a coup, had sought to escape house arrest, which his lawyers deny. The alleged escape plan involved getting to a hideout on the outskirts of the capital, Niamey, before taking helicopters belonging to a, quote, foreign power toward Nigeria. This according to a regime spokesman on state television. And Saudi Arabia is all but certain to host the men's 2034 World Cup. This after the Australian Soccer Federation decided not to enter the bidding contest. FIFA had set Tuesday as the deadline to formally declare interest in hosting the tournament, but Australia's decision not to enter the race leaves Saudi Arabia as the only declared candidate, to the dismay of many human rights activists. The Israel Defense Forces, with help from the Israeli Security Agency, conducted an airstrike that killed an important member of Hamas. VOA's Rick Pantaleo spoke with correspondent Natasha Mozgovia in Jerusalem about who this important target was, his significance, as well as the airstrike itself. Here's what she had to say.
Well, this is part of the operation that goes, as you know, on the ground, also with aerial support, and Israel targets not only the groups of militants, their infrastructure, they're also trying to find and eliminate those directly responsible for different parts of the operation of the attack that Hamas conducted against Israel on October 7th. So Nassim Abu Ajuna, he's the commander of the Beit Lahia Battalion of the Northern Division of Hamas. Probably people don't remember, but this person was already targeted in the past. So, say in May 2021, his house in Gaza was already basically demolished, attacked from air, because in his house, as IDF said back then, was militants' infrastructure. So this is something that obviously, if he wasn't eliminated, then he wasn't at home, right? But it was a message from IDF that he is on their list of sort of mid-level management, if we can apply it to a terrorist organization in this case. So basically, Israel in this operation has several objectives, but definitely targeting figures that can be tied to the attack. And this person was responsible, relying on what IDF says, for the part of the aerial attack of Hamas, which was paragliders, and also some of the drones operations that Hamas started utilizing in recent years. So he was responsible for that and for basically direct orders to attack two of the kibbutzim in Israel. So he was confirmed dead. I assume, again, that it is based on intelligence sources, because it's a aerial strike to see something happening on the ground. Ground forces usually do not reach those places that fast. Otherwise, you know, they would do it in the first place. But again, let's not go too deep into assumptions. We have information from the ground operation just trickling in, because IDF is obviously very cautious about revealing anything that might put its troops in further harm, because any picture, any location, it all can be used at this point against them. As we know, and as Hamas, I think, does not really hide, they have an extensive infrastructure. They're well prepared for guerrilla warfare or urban warfare.
Natasha, Israeli forces with their ground operations face a challenge that Hamas has military compounds within an extensive network of tunnels. How successful has Israel's operations been in dealing with Hamas in these tunnels?
We do not know this at this point. Again, as I said, Israel has been very cautious in releasing any information about the ongoing operation. Right now, basically, they just released two names of soldiers that were killed. So, but, you know, sometimes you need to read between the lines. And when we hear senior commanders of the army talking about, you know, very kind of somberly about the price and versus the goal, etc. So it basically, that's how usually the people are being prepared for higher numbers of casualties. How successful, that's really hard to say, but we should again remind that today we have a new tally of hostages And this complicates any operation on the ground to a great deal, because 240 people, mostly civilians, are including very young children, are still held by Hamas.
VOA's Rick Pantaleo speaking with correspondent Natasha Mazgovia in Jerusalem. From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. An economic view of Pakistan's expulsion of Afghan migrants in a moment. First, though, UN Security Council members received a briefing on the situation in Ukraine on Tuesday from Ramesh Rajasingham. He's the Director of Coordination for the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
While much of the international attention is rightly concentrated on the grave events in the Middle East, it is important that we do not lose focus on other crises, particularly not one as brutal and far-reaching as that precipitated by the war in Ukraine.
Rajasingham continued to say that because of the war, 80 million people need humanitarian assistance, and perhaps more troubling,
at the latest count, more than 9,900 civilians have been killed since the start of the invasion. To put this into perspective, this is equivalent to almost 16 civilians killed every day.
And in a related story, three Russians were arrested Tuesday in New York for evading U.S. sanctions to ship electronic components for weapons used by Russia in its war in Ukraine. The trio are accused of sending over 300 shipments of restricted items valued at approximately $10 million to the Russian battlefield. This, according to an agent with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The federal prosecutor's office said that more than $1.1 million in proceeds had been seized from domestic bank accounts. Components linked to the group's two Brooklyn-based companies have been found in seized Russian weapons platforms and signals intelligence equipment in Ukraine, including guided missile systems, drones, tanks, and helicopters, the Department of Justice said in a statement announcing the charges. And now to Central Africa, where millions have lost their homes in Congo's growing conflict. The AP's Charles Della Desma reports.
The United Nations Migration Agency says a record 6.9 million people have been displaced by conflict across Congo, making it one of the world's largest displacement and humanitarian crises. The International Organization for Migration says the decades-long conflict has been the primary reason for this displacement. The area has long been overrun by dozens of armed groups seeking a share of the region's gold and other resources. Now, outside multinational forces deployed to help stop the violence are under pressure to leave as frustration grows. I'm Charles Deledesma.
And finally today, as Afghans residing illegally in Pakistan leave on Islamabad's orders, many local business owners are seeing labor shortages and a decline in business activity. VOA's Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman reports from the bulk produce market in Islamabad, where Afghans make up the majority of traders, vendors, and manual labor.
Mornings are always busy in the bulk vegetable and fruit market in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Hundreds of thousands of boxes of produce are unloaded from trucks every day and auctioned for sale across the city. The market relies heavily on Afghans. Haji Nader owns a business here.
All of our dealings are with our Afghan brothers. They also work as laborers here. There are those who buy from us and sell onwards. Nearly 77% of the people associated with this business here are Afghans.
But things are changing. The Pakistani government's directive ordering Afghans residing without proper documentation to leave the country voluntarily by October 31st or face a crackdown from November 1st, spooked the market. Abdul Wahid is a trader.
I have three containers of produce waiting to be sold. It's been 15 days, and I haven't been able to sell even half a container. There's no buyer.
Nearly 1.7 million Afghans, many born in Pakistan, live illegally in the country, according to government data. Officials say nearly 200,000 have left in the last 2 months, fearing a crackdown. As Afghan businessmen figure out their future, their Pakistani counterparts, like Najibullah, are worried about their investments, which run hundreds of thousands of dollars. Business owner Najibullah is worried.
We don't do business in cash. It's all on credit. Afghans owe us money, and we owe them.
Fearing arrest, many Afghan laborers are skipping work. Nabi Khan works as a porter. His family has proper documentation, but his identification card has a hold on it.
I have spent my whole life here, and now I am facing this problem. It's possible that I will be separated from my family.
Lacking social protection, Afghans do grueling work for much less than their Pakistani counterparts, and vendors rely on them to keep costs low.
A shortage of cheap Afghan labor means the cost of business here could rise, and that can push up prices of produce for Pakistanis who are already dealing with sky-high inflation.
As Afghans leave in droves, finding trucks to transport produce is becoming hard, as vehicles are booked to move families with their belongings. With the pace of Afghan departures picking up, Pakistani businesses are bracing for major disruptions.
I'm losing sleep thinking how I will recover my money from another country if Afghans go back.
Over 4 million Afghans live in Pakistan, most of them legally. While many have faced crackdowns and eviction orders in the past, this is Pakistan's biggest deportation drive. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Islamabad.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At a Security Council briefing on the Central African Republic, or CAR, Ambassador Robert Wood, U.S. Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs, emphasized three key components necessary for the CAR government to succeed in protecting civilians and providing stability. The first is the essential role of MINUSCA, the UN Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission, whose mandate for renewal is coming up in November. Ambassador Wood mourned the recent deaths and injuries of several mission peacekeepers.
Despite the difficult operating environment, MINUSCA has made contributions to peace and security over the past year in partnership with the Central African Republic government and civil society. Joint operations and enhanced mobility of mission personnel are an important means to empower the country's security forces to provide for the Central African people and support a durable and responsible restoration of state authority.
He also praised MINUSCA's role in mitigating the threat of explosive ordnance through risk reduction sessions for over 5,000 civilians and capacity building for national forces, as well as the CAR government's decision to create a national authority to address the ordnance threat. The second key component, Ambassador Wood said, is for the CAR's partners, including MINUSCA, to support local elections, scheduled for October 2024. The elections, he underscored, must be conducted in a transparent, timely, and inclusive manner.
It has been far too long since Central Africans have been able to elect local leaders. We stress the importance of the full, equal, and meaningful participation of women and youth at all levels in political dialogue and throughout the elections process.
Finally, said Ambassador Wood, while it is important to combat the armed groups that refuse to participate in the peace process, the CAR government should resume dialogue with the opposition and armed groups within the framework of the peace process and for the opposition to engage constructively. Mr. Wood also warned against the Wagner Group.
It is well documented that Kremlin-backed Wagner Group forces are engaging in illicit extraction of the CAR's mineral wealth, without contributing to the country's development.
We call upon all actors to choose the path of peace, said Ambassador Wood. The Central African people deserve a political solution that will unlock the country's potential. The United States remains a steadfast partner of the Central African people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.